So we're continuing a series of talks on the precepts. And I was thinking, as I was sitting, I was thinking about how you can't take Buddhism and slice it into individual sections and then pull out a piece of it, study it, and then put it back and then take another. It's a little bit like slicing off a piece of your body and expecting to see the whole of the teaching through any one digit of the finger. That's not the best. But you get what I mean. The point is that there's an embodiment of the teaching, an embodiment, a way that the teaching says. What it is trying to do is to create an embodiment of freedom. And all aspects of the teaching have to do with that. It's actually, the more you get into it, the more you see that it's all laced together in some meticulous and ingenious fashion. So we can study the precepts like we could the Ten Commandments, but they would be useless in that way. But if you see that the precepts is a call to hold the world in a certain way through our action, and that along with the workings of the meditation process and how we work with the meditative on an active and ongoing basis, along with how we hold our speech, our livelihood, and everything we do, and our inward world, which is also what we've been practicing here, that all of that together, the whole embodiment of the teaching, and begins to speak to stillness, to accessing stillness. But if we don't know the Four Noble Truths and we try to do the precepts, it falters, because the Four Noble Truths from the beginning say you have to go into the pain. You have to go into the pain, right? That's truth one. That suffering is where the action is. It's where the problem resides. You have to go into that. So we have to know that pain is an indication that we are not within the embodiment, the alignment of freedom. And therefore, when we take on the training, the ethical training, the five precepts, and we begin to hurt because we're not living up to what we thought we were going to do, to the precepts, that hurt represents something. It represents something that we need to investigate, to look deeply into, because it is there in that fixation of our response, whether it be the selfish response to the world or the arrogance we hold or whatever. It's within that that the view or the embodiment breaks down. So we follow the pain of where the precepts take us because we aren't living up to them, not to foster guilt and shame, but to see where we've contracted and distanced ourselves, where we've broken ourselves off, disconnected, and then to regain an embodiment, the body. I was speaking to somebody who came up right before the class, and he was saying that I talked about the posture and how we hold ourselves in the posture, and that so many of us have a particular posture that holds an attitude, and when we correct that posture and just holding our shoulders back, suddenly we're not able to hold on to the old attitude anymore, and so we have to change our whole way of perceiving ourselves and others. And very quickly, we'll find ourselves going back to the old attitude, because that's a very uncomfortable way to be. And yet, so that's what I'm saying, do you see? That when we hold our posture in a certain way, ethically, within wise speech, action, livelihood, and working with the samadhi, the meditation, because the Buddha taught sila, samadhi, and panya, wisdom, ethics, and meditation, that suddenly we're not able to hold our old style of life. The body embodying the teaching changes the psychic posture, you might say, and thus we're challenged. We begin to see the way we have lived. It begins to reveal the way we have lived. It begins to show us the shadow side of our life. You know, what's happening in the Catholic Church now is actually a very good indication of that same thing. That as long as the priests were thought to be godly, nobody challenged whatever they did. But when they become human beings, which is what we're becoming, then the shadow, you can't tolerate the shadow anymore. Human quality, I mean, as long as you project something on to life, it's supposed to be, you know, then you can be lost in your selfishness. But as soon as you take the posture of a human being and connectedness, you can't hold the shadow anymore. The shadow comes forth. And so the precepts, that's why last week when we formally took the precepts, it's so important, because in that moment, there you are saying something to your shadow. And there's use to ritual, because it's a formal way of saying, all right, I am taking this on. Come at me if you will. I don't care. Come at me. And it will, in the form of the pain body. Now, how we did it, we have to. You can make anything a habit. I think Rajiv said you can sleep through any alarm clock. And it's true. I mean, you can take it on just habitual. And in some of the Buddhist countries, the formal, you know, you just do it because you've done it every day in your whole life, and it doesn't mean anything to you. But if you say to yourself, okay, wait a minute, I'm going to open up to a new way of being here, then the old way of being just doesn't die out. It comes at you tooth and nail. So that, you see, the form is a challenge to the pain body. The pain body will arise to that challenge. But if we just stay on the safe side, you'll stay bent over and die bent over with rounded shoulders. So the precepts are not a small thing. This is not, oh, be good, you know, don't hurt people. You know, it's not that. This is the embodiment of the teaching. And the homework helps us come to that. It helps us, it's making a statement. Okay, this week I'm going to work with the first precept as an embodiment and watch all of the different shadowed areas in which I've hidden from my whole life in terms of my ignorance and my arrogance. I'm going to open up to those areas and become clear in this one particular quality. So it's interesting where the word sila comes from. Sila comes in Pali. It's a Pali word that means rock, bedrock. And it's the bedrock of our practice, really. I think Marcel Proust said, we are not looking for new landscapes. We're just changing how we see. The search, spiritual search, is not in looking for new landscapes. It's changing how we see the landscape we're already in. So that's what we're doing. Buddhism is very pragmatic. It's very down to earth. It doesn't make a projected significance out of anything. So we don't form any priests here. We have a very even relationship. And there's a downside to that. In some of the other traditions like Zen and Tibetan, elevating the teacher also elevates one's aspirations to move into that, to move into that lifestyle. And at some point, there's the inevitable conflict between the ideal and the actual. And we also, we can set up the guru or the priest or the roshi to do anything like the priests of the Catholic Church do. But the downside of just having a spiritual friend up here is that the aspirations don't... You think, oh, he's just another guy. Why do I want to practice 25 years and just do that? You see? So I'd rather fool myself. You see? But the beauty of it, the positive, is that it's human being to human being. So here we are. This is it. We're just human being to human being. Now let's have at it at this level. So there's three ways to understand sila. Sila is ethical training. The first is in terms of the training rules. The movement, it's a movement towards restraint. It's a training. It's the way, okay, I'll limit my immediate response, habitual response of swatting mosquitoes and let in another response. So it's a restraint from the old patterns and ways we've conditioned ourselves to see if to allow the embodiment to be there, to pause so that there can be an embodiment. It also can be seen as a protection from ourselves, really, the pause that refreshes, the pause that allows myself and my old habits and the way I've treated myself and others to abate for a moment. So that's the first thing that the precepts do. The second is that they offer, as a principle, they offer non-harm and a guideline for compassionate action. You can ask yourself as you're carrying them, is this, okay, so this is another form of the embodiment, you see. Okay, now non-harm. From the view of wisdom, non-harm is a byproduct. It's something that it's absolutely evident from the view of freedom. The Buddha said he wrote down the precepts from the free mind. They're evident. They're self-evident. And so, of course, you want to do non-harm. So they're a statement of that intent and purpose to do non-harm. And non-harm, of course, is also an open-hearted response to people so that the compassionate form and access to the pain of the world, when we're not causing the pain, we access to all the pain that is there that we're not causing, but that's out in front of our eyes all the time. When we're busy causing our own pain and disturbance, we're lost in the pain and pleasure principles. And we can't see a thing. When you're hurting, how much time do you ever have to listen to somebody else's problems? When you're pursuing what you want at the sake of everything else, everything that gets in your way of that has no business in your life whatsoever. And it's unless we are not causing pain, lest we just sit back and restrain that temptation to constantly move towards pain and pleasure, that we can actually allow the pain of the world to come into our hearts, which is one of the reasons that we pursue pain and pleasure so that it won't come in, because it hurts too much for it to come in. And if I keep myself on a pleasure principle, I can dull, addict myself to such a degree that I won't have to feel the pain that I both live with internally and that I see in front of me evident, in evidence everywhere I go. There's no way, there's no escape in spirituality from the sensitive heart. There's no escape from that. So if that's not your path, then this isn't your path. And the precepts are just about that. Okay, so let me see what's going on here. Let me not be so addicted to my own needs. I was sitting on the plane coming back yesterday, and there was a woman sitting behind me speaking to a second woman, and she had just had a baby. And it was about an hour flight. And the whole flight was about her child. And the other woman didn't say 10 words. And she was just talking. And her whole life was around the pleasure of that child. But she couldn't even take in who she was speaking to. There was no room in her life for anything else but her relating to that child. And because it was so exciting to her, she felt it was exciting to all people. It's also a call, the ethical conduct precepts are also a call to how to move into generosity. The generosity. So when we're not so caught in the pain and pleasure principle, we have room in our hearts to share, to listen, to move, to actually converse rather than just to talk to or talk about. Exactly. The woman could be behind me in that plane, and she could have had just a recent divorce, and she would have spent the whole plane talking about that problem. Pleasure, pain, they do the same thing. The third way that sila is to be understood is that it's a call towards wise view. So that we really do begin to get a sense that when we're not so locked up in our own arrogance and our own needs, that some other way, some other aspect, some other sense of connection in the world can come forth. And the precepts allow that to come forth. So the embodiment of the teaching, again, is in the cells of our response. So actions that move towards separation, creating distance, creating a schism. Okay, so that's pain. Okay, I'm not into pain at the moment. This is what the precepts are about. I'm not going to do that. All right. So I pull back, and now when I'm not into pain, when I want to hold the posture of non-harm, I see things coming back together. I actually involve myself in action, speech, and mind towards bringing those things together. And so I'm moving towards healing rather than towards a greater rift, greater distance. And if you just think what our usual definition of evil is, we can summarize it in terms of that which distances. Separates. And good is that which brings things together. So you could be saying that you're working towards good, but if you get caught in being good or trying to do good, then we're caught in the whole separation again, because there's good and bad, and we've just created a whole divide. So it's very tricky. This is very tricky stuff. It's not, and boy, if we're, especially if we've had backgrounds in which our religious training has been ethically based, and that's how we've known it to be, then our tendencies are going to be coming out as a pain body towards shame and guilt all along the way here. Very strong sense. I was sitting, I was doing a retreat in Eugene, Oregon this weekend, and I was going all day long doing groups and talking and speaking, so I never had a cup of tea, but food and drink weren't allowed in the meditation hall. So I went out and we had the groups in the meditation hall, I went out and got a cup of tea, and I brought it into the meditation hall because I wasn't drinking anything, and I was going the whole day, and I was never getting outside the meditation hall because it was just continuous while everyone else was walking, doing walkings and that. So one of the meditators there said, "You can't bring tea into this room." I said, "Well, why can't I?" They said, "Well, it says right on the door, no food or drink in the room." So you want me to just die of thirst? And say, "No, you're not going to drink. I don't care if you're dying or not. You're not going to drink." What's the spirit behind it? What's the, not the form, but what is this, what's the message of the law? What is the spirit it's trying to do? Let's not spill water and food on the room. So I will be very careful not to do that. I will be responsible. I'll be a responsible adult. But we get caught in the rule, you know, the rule. Because our minds love rules. Our minds love the dichotomy of good and bad. We can get a fix on that one, can't we? We hate ambiguity. But the practice is all about ambiguity. It's not about control or will. It's about ambiguity. How are you in ambiguity? I don't even have to ask that question. I know how we all are. So the first precept is what I wanted to speak about tonight. And we're two-thirds finished, and we haven't spoken a word about it. So the first precept. So how to understand this precept in light of what I was just saying in terms of the precept, that to abstain from taking life. It's really a call to investigate, to ponder, to halt, to investigate, to look and to see, to stay, okay, what, to look at ourselves and our species and to see the coarseness of action. It doesn't take much to see where this species is going. Turn on the nightly news. And I was reading that by the end of this century, half of the species that are remaining on Earth will have vanished by the end of this 100 years. That's not the ones that were there back 300 years ago. That's the ones that started in the year 2000. Most of that extinction due to man and woman. Isn't that the most arrogant? That our species somehow dominates and predominates and controls, and everything takes a second tier to that. Why? Because we can think. So is life a hierarchy? Is it built on those kinds of principles? Because when I look at how we act and what our motivations are and the way this culture seems to be moving, I wouldn't say that we were anything but animalistic in its outcome. We like to pretend that we've risen above the animal realm, but I don't really see that. I just reflecting on the Olympics and how the U.S., even this culture, kept itself so prestigious and, you know, just above the other countries. It was appalling to me just to see how we were behaving as a country, as if we were the only country that had ever been hurt. We never question our arrogance. And this precept is a call to question our arrogance. So does this precept mean that we are never to kill? Because that's impossible. Life lives on life. Does it say that we are to... Because there are sects in India that try to do just that. The Jains, for instance, put gauze over their mouths so they won't breathe in any organisms. They brush the paths of where they walk so they won't step on anything. And our whole life could be consumed to put that. But that is just not bringing food and drink into the meditation hall. That's not the spirit of what's behind the rule. That's following the rule to the extreme, from my point of view. What's the spirit behind the rule? Is to open our hearts. Not to be self-righteous. Not to be more opinionated and more arrogant because I'm better at my precept than you're at keeping yours. But to open our heart to connectedness. But then again, we have to feel the pain. And unless we know the whole of the teaching, we're going to avoid pain. Because why wouldn't we? Pain hurts. Especially the pain I carry in relationship to my own actions. And the pain I carry in relationship to how I treat myself. But I don't want to look at that. And so much of violence comes from the inability to look at our anger. Does it not? It comes from the reaction to the anger, not from being able to hold or feel the anger. And then the opinions raise us up to a level of dominance and control and empowerment and I've forgotten the message of the Buddha. We can't just take the head of the Buddha. We have to take the whole of him. Everything. There are many ways to kill. Many ways to kill. The most obvious one is the annihilation, is the elimination, is the extermination, is the genocide. Forget how many million people died the last century. I think from after the Second World War, 100 million people died since the Second World War. So when we... So when we are willing to feel what is behind the violence, when we're willing to be accountable for the pain from which the violence moves, when we're willing to feel the anger rather than to react from the anger, when we're willing to connect, listen to the words, when we're willing to connect with the emotion that drives the behavior, then we're willing to embody the teaching. But that means we have to be willing to face the pain rather than to extend the pain through empowerment beyond ourselves to a new person or population. Do you see that? So there's a lot of learning that the precepts require. Because murder is an attempt to murder the emotion. And we have to also understand that no single perspective is a total truth. Look at the worlds that are being fought now from perspective and opinion. Be it religion or culture, Israelis and Palestinians, and when we live not crystallized around our own opinion, then we live with the ambiguity in which no one opinion is the defined truth. Try to do that. See how difficult it is. You can see why humankind has perpetuated its violence for generation after generation. And then we'll know why the Buddha said that anger never ceases with anger. That it perpetuates itself. But that is the rawest form of the first precept. There are many forms of the first precept that we do every day. We can become very self-righteous in our rules, in our stance, in our ethical training. And yet it's that very self-righteousness that perpetuates the violence. Our raging thoughts that are never put to action. Road rage. As a person cuts in line. I was at the airport. Most of my stories are from the airport these days. And it was early in the year when the lines literally were about a quarter of a mile long. And I looked at the line, I went all the way down the escalator and around, and and to the end of the line. And just as I was coming in to the end of the line, somebody else was coming in this way, and we kind of met at exactly the same time, and then I just eased myself ahead of this person. So we're talking about a line a quarter of a mile long. This person was so angry that I got one person ahead in a quarter of a mile line. She said, "I think you went right ahead of me on purpose." I said, "I thought we arrived at the same time." She said, "I think you should give me your place." I said, "I'm not going to do that." She nagged me for an hour. And I got more and more stubborn. This woman is not getting ahead of me. Then we went into these gates. Some of you have been, and they separate you out. And she beat me to the... That's how petty. That is how petty it becomes. The rage that we are thinking is only an impulse away from murder. Given the right situation, the right circumstances, how about negation, negating someone, dismissing them, as if their voice didn't matter? Isn't that a murder? My voice, not, doesn't matter what you have to say. Been in meetings with people like that? Or the dismissive quality when you hurt someone and you know it, and then you think, "Oh, she or he deserved it anyway. He deserved that. They're always doing that kind of dismissive quality." Or the murder of prejudice, where a person is not allowed to be a person, but a category and a stereotype. And we have murdered the person and fit the person into a stereotype. Isn't that murder? See, there's only an incremental difference in these different steps. This is the violence internally. How about the violence we do ourselves with the judgments, the beratement, the self-dislike? How our opinion, how we hold ourselves in the world in a murderous posture, never allowing ourselves the full embodiment of being a human being. How about that one? Some of your heads are going down. Keep your heads up. This is challenging. Precepts are challenging. Precepts should challenge us. The root of all these murders are the same. The root is the same, be it of other or of self. All violence occurs from opinions. From the reaction of ambiguity. Now, just for a second, because I feel it's very strong, the silence. The silence brings forth non-distinction. That's what silence does. The mind's job is to make preferences, to make the world concrete and known. But in silence, in stillness, There's ambiguity. There aren't preferences. The edges of things blur. Not visually, not sensorially, but heart. Because nothing is being made of something. Nothing is distinct in value. And it's here that we sit. This is the end of violence. You can't force yourself into this state because that's just more violence. You have to embody it. You have to use everything that you have at your disposal, all aspects of the teaching, to embody stillness. And every part of your being is going to be tested because every part of your being stakes itself in distinction, in contrast. So the precepts are a call towards the ambiguous. Now we're getting in it. I like it down here, where we're feeling the embodiment of the teaching together. You know, the statue of the Pietà, where violence, the very act of violence, was on the lap of the Virgin Mary, draped. And the way the statue holds that form. In stillness. This is the pointing of the precepts. This is the pointing of the codes of conduct. This is, we just have to decondition our reference to the Ten Commandments. It's not about that at all. We're way past that. This is about the full range of the human heart. And using everything at our disposal, including training rules, to access that heart.